Hello, and welcome to this episode of Not a Lady, a Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman podcast. My name is Sarah.
And I'm Kelly.
And this is episode 3 of season 2, titled Halloween.
Which, it's almost Halloween.
I was waiting for you to start singing.
This is Halloween, this is Halloween. I wanted to, but then I was like, then people are going to think I like Halloween, and I actually don't really like Halloween.
Like, at all?
I'm sure, like, maybe if I have kids one day, I'll like it and it'll be fun, but I don't really like Halloween that much.
Anytime it is socially acceptable for me to dress up as not myself, I love it, right? Whether it be Halloween or a Renaissance fair, yeah, or a school play, that is my happy place when I don't have to be myself. So I like the costume part of Halloween.
Yeah,
like trick-or-treating, I could probably live without.
Yeah.
But like walking around and seeing people's costumes, that's cool.
And it's not like we didn't go trick-or-treating as kids. We did.
Yeah, we did.
But
we did.
I think I just got older and was like, people turn Halloween into this weird thing that I don't like. So anyway.
Spooky month. Speaking of spooky things, like, I made this joke in our last episode about the opening with Dorothy walking through the town being like Dr. Quinn the horror movie. But then they did this episode and I'm like, wait, actually this one is kind of the, I wouldn't say horror movie, but definitely haunting, right?
It's supposed to be, yeah.
So that was kind of funny. They're trying a lot of new things this season, and I'm okay with it, actually. But with the mention of Sanctuary, we, of course, want to talk about our lessons and write-ins related to that episode. Let's start with a write-in on Twitter, because our Twitter doesn't get much love. So Dade Star Mysteries wrote in, not as much of a lesson, but more of a discussion point about Sanctuary, and said, I watched this episode recently. I still don't understand Hank's, all he did was hit her. I don't want to know what apparently goes on Hank's list of things you can do to your wife. Then he says he's done worse to his horse. What's his point?
There is no point other than to be like, it's not that big of a deal.
Right. Yeah. And my response to that was, I think his point is that being hit is no quote unquote excuse for a woman fighting back. It's
right.
Her job to just accept it.
Which I'm sure Hank doesn't think there's really any reason for a woman to fight back, let's be honest. But
yeah. Dade Star Mysteries added, that is a very messed up mentality, which I heartily agree.
The OG Grateful Fan, which she wrote that. I didn't just say that, although she is the OG.
I mean,
OG.
We dubbed her OG Grateful Fan.
She is. She says, I guess a very obvious lesson is that Dorothy learned that she could trust Dr. Mike. I mean, if you think about it, Dr. Mike was not her friend. She wasn't really even her sister's friend. She's a random lady doctor that apparently will go hard for something she believes in, whether she knows you or not. Which I guess I didn't think of that too much because, right, I've seen the show before. So I'm like, yeah, Dorothy and Mike are friends, very good friends. But I mean, it could have been seen as very intrusive. But I like the comment that she says that, you know, apparently she will go hard for something she believes in, whether she knows you or not.
If we look at the core of Dr. Mike, like on paper, right, as a character, I would agree with that. Like wholeheartedly, like that if she's showed us anything about herself, that's true. Like if she believes in something enough, she's not gonna sit by and be silent. Silence is approval. We got an email from Liz Marie. She said, I guess what I take away from the episode is that you shouldn't judge others because you never know what they are going through. And it is easy to say you would have acted differently from a spectator's perspective when you aren't the one surviving the trauma. Also, and equally important, we learn that women are stronger together. In today's society, a lot of women fight each other. In my personal and professional life, I always fight with other women and not against them. Followed by what came up multiple times, both on Twitter and in this email, was, by the way, are you guys Swifties? Because you talked about Taylor Swift a lot last episode. And I was like, oops, I
I love seeing those comments because yes, we are.
I didn't actually realize that we were doing that.
How many times?
Like,
I didn't either till I re-listened to the episode after you sent me that screenshot, and I was like, oh yeah, we did. I love it.
I think we had one more lesson.
We did, and it's from Julie, who says, just because something is tradition or has always been done that way doesn't necessarily mean you have to like it. And depending upon what it is, there just might be a new, better way.
Thanks, everybody, for writing in. You can, of course, write in new lessons based on this episode. But before you can do that, we actually have to talk about it. So let's get started. Season 2, Episode 3, titled Halloween, aired, very fittingly, on the 30th of October, 1993. The director was Chuck Bowman. The last episode he directed was The Race, and the writer was Tony Graffia. And of course, Beth Sullivan got creator credit. I believe Tony Graffia's second writing stint, the last episode Tony Graffia wrote was The Secret. So I am looking forward to discussing some shared themes and some shared focuses of Tony Graffia's writing style between The Secret and this episode.
And we open with the kids in the barn, and Matthew is leading them in a circle where they are calling spirits of dead people. Matthew calling what? What are you laughing?
Spirits of dead people.
Am I wrong? Spirits of the deceased, is that more like appropriate?
No, I don't know how you summoning the dead. Summoning
I
ghost.
Said that because
ghost calling.
Because then Matthew's like, oh, pick anyone, and he's like, anyone dead, and that's when Colleen's like, Abraham Lincoln.
Who died in 1865, by the way.
And before she decides to summon Abe Lincoln, Matthew actually is calling the spirit of Running Arrow, who is a Cheyenne. And I believe he gives some bit of information that he died at Sand Creek Massacre.
That is correct.
Right. So he summons Running Arrow and they hear a wolf, in which Matthew says, oh, people say that he lives on in the spirit of a wolf. Therefore, he responded, when they call Abe Lincoln, there's a breeze that runs through the barn that they believe is Abe Lincoln. And when it gets to Brian's turn, he decides he wants to speak to their ma. I kind of like that you're not sure, right? Is Matthew going to be like, no, we're not going to do that. But he doesn't. He encourages Brian to go ahead. And unfortunately, nothing out of the ordinary happens in that moment, which kind of occurs to Brian that their ma isn't responding to them. And before they can try again, Dr. Mike actually comes into the barn to find out what they're doing. And it's very funny because Colleen and Brian, especially Brian, is really trying to convince Dr. Mike that there really, really were ghosts. They really were talking to ghosts.
Like, she calls it a game.
Right.
And that upsets Brian, who does a pretty quick turnaround, right? In the beginning, he's like, I don't hear anything. And then he's like, no, it was real ghosts. It wasn't a draft. Okay, you have to believe me. Which I think is like very typical kid, right?
Yeah.
I realized watching this scene how few scenes we get like this where it's just the kids.
True.
So often we get Dr. Mike and one or two of the kids or all three of the kids or one of the kids with another character. And I cannot think of another scene where it was really, maybe other than in the pilot, but where it was really just the three of them,
right,
allowed to be siblings and have a conversation together. And I really liked it. I'm going to keep my eye out for more scenes like that because I think it was a nice moment.
True.
I could not find any evidence of Running Arrow. I like to give the writers the benefit of the doubt, but sometimes I think they just make up Native American names. And so Running Arrow, I'm like, that's kind of the most stereotypical.
There are a lot of running. Insert noun here. Yeah.
We have talked about the Sand Creek Massacre before, but I don't want to just skim over it because it is a historical event. In 1864, after a long night of drinking, John M. Shivington led 700 members of the U.S. Cavalry against anywhere from 60 to 200 natives living at the time under the protection of Chief Black Kettle. He was praised by a majority. Shivington was praised by a majority of white people, I guess, for being a hero. I mean, the whole thing is horrible and tragic, but there were three investigations of the event and two trials as a response to this, and Shivington was removed from his post, but it was not the massacre itself that was a big part of the investigation. What was a big part of the investigation was that US military had mutilated the bodies. The reason they did that was to do with there's a Cheyenne belief that the scars and the wounds you have in death, you carry with you into the afterlife. And so it was a way that the US military believed that they were subduing the natives by putting a fear in them, not just of death, but having to go into the afterlife with these terrible mutilated bodies. It's horrible, and I never want to just ignore genocide and be like, oh yeah, that's a thing that happened. Native Americans are still here, and I want to make sure their history is told just as much as any of the other history. I would assume that Matthew knows about running Arrow from Cloud Dancing or Sully.
Yeah.
I'm wondering the significance just of bringing up Running Arrow, and I think it actually, it ties into the next scene where Dr. Mike and Sully are cleaning up from dinner, and Sully starts talking about the Cheyenne belief of this god who watches over human souls, and how there's, I couldn't find anything on, he says, leaving out sweets or candy to bring them there. But the gist of it is that most Native American religion is based in animism or totemism, which is really centered around this belief that all living things have souls. And this indigenous belief transfers into this. So this is an interesting thing that I'm going to bring up. I read this article that there was a indigenous belief that you should not wake a sleeping man, because when people sleep, their souls are wandering. And when they're experiencing, obviously, dreams and visions, like the Cheyenne, we've already seen that, like,
right,
in Rite of Passage. That is a very important and sacred time. There's two parts, right? Don't wake a sleeping man because his spirit or his soul is wandering. And also this idea that when we sleep, that our souls are wandering and we're confronting some of our own fears and challenges. And I think when I read that, there is nothing in this episode that ties this all together, but I think this fact actually ties in all three of our kind of storylines going on here. Part of the reason I wanted to mention it. But the scene, obviously, Dr. Mike, she's going her science path where she's just saying, yo.
She said that. Direct she quote. Says, yo.
Yo, hogwash. That's silly. And Sully gets a little offended. He should be able to share.
Right. She dismisses it pretty.
Sometimes it's weird because you don't know if Sully actually believes it or if he just wants the freedom to share about it. But then it's good. They try to be adults about it. You know, we don't have to agree on everything, which is true. And then he goes to kiss her on the cheek. And then the shelf with the family picture falls off the wall.
Dun, 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 dun.
And she looks... like
she looks at him like
I don't like she looks really devastated.
What does this mean? Even though I just said that people's because the line that she has to him refuting the whole ghost thing is people see what they want to see.
Exactly.
And he'll accuse her later of reading into things, so I'm like, it was just kind of funny when that happens. Title sequence then happens directly afterwards. Okay, I want to talk about this soon because I'm confused. They're sitting at the dinner table at the homestead talking about how it's almost Halloween, and Dr. Mike goes, what do you do here to celebrate? And they go on and on. But before we say what they say, when do we think that she arrived? What time of year again?
The end of the pilot is Christmas of her first year. Yeah.
I'm trying to think. She's acting like she's never been around for October before, which makes zero sense.
It makes zero sense because later she tells Lauren that she's been living in her house for almost a year. And I wrote in all caps, almost a year?
Yeah, I feel like it's fine. It's just one of those moments that the Bible thing probably didn't. The show Bible. I don't want someone to
you
listen.
Say the Bible
exactly.
Thing.
I'm like, someone that hasn't listened to this is gonna listen and be like, I'm sorry, what? Dr. Quinn's in the Bible? So it was fine. I just was like, okay, this is annoying me because clearly you've been here long enough. You and Sully, I just was like, okay.
speaking what we've seen, it's true. She's only had one Christmas and one birthday. And remember, I was weirded out about the birthday, yeah, too, because her birthday's supposed to be in February, and that was her first birthday at the house, but that was, like, episode 12 in, you know, it felt like all this time has, right, gone by, and even in this episode, is this the same day? Because it is, this is one long stinking day.
Yeah.
They're not great at the whole timeline thing, which we have established before, but yeah, that's a good point.
Anyway, so she says, like, what do you guys do around here to celebrate? And they talk about contests and games and all these things, and then they talk about, well, Brian talks about the peeling toss, in which you toss apples behind you and they spell out the initials of your spouse. And then
I bet it be a big S. I cracked up.
She's like, Brian.
I know. It was pretty cute. Well, I want to talk about Halloween.
This is Halloween. What other Halloween songs are there?
You know, I've never seen that movie.
Neither have I. I've never seen that. I've never seen Hocus Pocus. I know people really like that movie.
Casper the Friendly Ghost. Never seen.
Can't say I've seen that.
I have seen Halloween Town, the Disney Halloween Town.
Haven't seen that.
Halloween. So I'm sure there is someone who could do a whole lecture on the actual many, many layers of history of Halloween. I have broken it down into its simplest pieces. So the original festival that is considered the pagan inspiration, origins of Halloween, is the Festival of Samhain. And it's a Celtic tradition. It was a festival that was to welcome the dark half of the year, the transition into the fall season. And the belief was that during that transition from summer to fall into winter, that the borders, the boundaries between the physical and spiritual world were broken down and thinned. And so it's during this time that many of the ghosts of the dead would return. Celtic tradition was to sacrifice to the Celtic deities, and this festival was a part of all that. Now, Rome, most people know the Roman Empire, one of the greatest empires in history, did take over Celtic territory. I think they had claim of most of it around 40 AD. And there was also a Roman holiday called Feralia. I'm not quite sure actually how to pronounce it, but it was celebrated in October, and it was to commemorate the passing of the dead. So the Romans move into Celtic territory. They would lay tribute for the Roman goddess Pomona, who's the goddess of fruits and vegetables, and her symbol was an apple. And this is how an apple kind of became an iconic fruit of
fall
festival. Later, of course, in 609 AD, the Catholic Church obviously wants to Christianize some of these traditions. And so they establish what's called All Saints Day, previously was All Martyrs Day. And that brings, especially into Western Europe, kind of the Christian tradition. So the next kind of big jump would be, obviously, when did it come to America? Because we know, as far as Europeans coming to America, the majority of the ones that come to stay were seeking freedom from religious persecution. This is obviously post-conquistador conquerors. The jerky people. They're all jerk. Everyone in history is a jerk to someone else at some time. But I don't know that that's true. That's a broad generalization that I'm just saying.
Take it back.
I feel like you can find dirt on everybody. But yeah. Anyway, all that being said, when did probably some of these Halloween traditions come to America? I think it was heightened during the late Irish immigration, because you're going to see that Samhain was that Celtic tradition influenced by the Roman occupation. And then when you have these Irish immigrants coming to the United States, that's when they're bringing some of these cultural traditions to America. Obviously, there's a lot more details in there, links on our website for more articles on it, but these are kind of just some of the foundational influences into what is now, you know, our modern day, quote unquote, Halloween.
Got it. Sully shows up just as we're talking about the big S and comes in and has showed up to hang this shelf.
Have you ever seen him that peppy?
He's motivated. What can I say? We are like a motivated man. He is ready to hang the shelf that fell over the night previously. Then he kind of starts talking about he wants to fix up the homestead, talking about all these possibilities, in which the entire time Dr. Mike is kind of refuting, saying, there's plenty of space here. We're good. We don't need to do that.
I love that line where she's like, we have plenty of space. And Matthew's like, no, we don't. And I'm like, he sleeps in the barn, woman.
Right. That is the funny part, right? And it kind of gets down to this point where Sully's finally like, is there something wrong, Dr. Mike? Like, what's the issue? She says, no, everything's fine. I'm just finally getting comfortable here, which again, what? I don't want any big changes, which we can relate to.
Yeah.
We'll see this further continue this conversation.
Do you remember? So Kelly and I, we shared a room.
Gosh, what are you about to say?
I guess probably until, at least until I was in high school, we shared a room. But I bring it up because Mom would like to rearrange. Every once in a while, she would just want to rearrange the furniture.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you remember this, but every time she would do it, I would cry for days.
I don't remember that.
I would get so stressed out because she would just not, like, sometimes I think she got better at it once she realized that it was an issue.
I mean, they were small rooms. You can only do so much with it.
No, they were so small. Right. No, exactly. It was like she moved the bed. You know, she switched where the bed and the dresser were. Like, yeah. That's what I mean by move. It was very small. But I would have a meltdown. And I think Mom started to realize, like, I'm not a quick transitioner. And then she would start to talk to me like, hey, I think we should rearrange the room. This is what I'm thinking. What are you thinking? And then I would think about it. And then if I was able to be a part of the decision making, and then I did better. I'm also that person who every time Mom would bring me home from getting my hair cut, I would cry. I just am one of those people who doesn't do quick change well. Like, I need time to transition. I need time to, like, process it so that I know that I can, like, handle it. This is, like, hello personality types, I guess. There's probably a whole psychological analysis you could do probably on it right now. But when Dr. Mike was saying this in the scene, I was like, yeah, I get it. It's control of her own space, right? Besides the superstitions and stuff that she's gonna have, which they're not really gonna ever address how she went from being like, no, it's not real, to being like, oh, actually, I'm dealing with this. In that moment, I was like, I get this.
Which is funny because, like, I wanted to understand, but then I'm like, you're being dumb, Dr. Mike. Like, it's his house. Like, what a nice thing for him to do for you. And I think at this point, we're not really sure where she's coming from. And I think as we go on, then we'll kind of figure out, like, what's going on in her head.
The next scene, we're at school.
The school.
I have sad news.
What?
I saw the profile picture, the actor who plays Lewis named David Tom. And I was like, oh, he grew up to be not an unattractive young man.
Oh, no, don't say that. That's rude.
No, he grew up to be quite handsome. So I clicked on his thing and then scrolled to just look and see how many episodes of Dr. Quinn he was in. I have bad news for us, friends.
I could have told you that.
This is Lewis's last episode.
I was shocked that we do see him again because I was convinced that he's not in another episode.
I can't believe it. Maybe he went to work on another project, but I was, like, very upset to realize this was his final episode.
He looks very different as a grown-up.
He does look so different, right? You don't realize how the glasses and the haircut made him look super dweeby in this show, but he grew up to... Yeah, I would never have recognized him.
Yeah.
Anyway. The students, of course, they're sitting at lunch and having a conversation about witches. And, of course, they're talking about the Salem witch trial.
Witch trials. Oh, gosh. You gonna get a big history lesson?
Yes, it always is at the beginning, okay? If you all haven't realized this right now, Dr. Quinn only puts their historical facts in the first 5 minutes of the show.
And the medical's always later.
Salem witch trials, I think most people probably studied, if not the Salem witch trials themselves, in English class, you probably read or watched The Crucible, either the play or watched the film adaptation. Definitely recommend Winona Ryder, Daniel Day-Lewis. It makes me cry. 1692, when the Salem witch trials took place. Do you know... Oh no, I'm doing that thing. Do you know the theories, Kelly, on why the Salem witch trials happened, other than the obvious, which is like religious hysteria, which is definitely a thing? Do you remember learning about, or did you ever read about, or have you ever talked about what they think the cause of the Salem witch trials? Should I talk people through what the Salem witch trials are? I'm assuming that people know what they are, yeah. But maybe they don't.
I think most people do. I thought it might be something similar to this thing in medicine that's similar to somatic disorder, which is basically people pretend that they have symptoms and then other people that pretend they have symptoms and whatever. I'm sure I learned other reasons in school, but other than that, I can't really think of anything.
Obviously, we don't know for sure. Over 150 people in this Puritan village of Salem were accused by mostly teenage and young girls who went into hysterics, screaming, hurting themselves, were seeing things. And the first person to be accused was, of course, one of renowned family's slaves named Tituba. And she confessed under torture and a lot of pressure, probably from knowing that as a black person in this Puritan village, it didn't matter whether she was guilty or not. If she didn't confess, they were going to put her to death. 18 were put to death, not all of them women, 6 men. And those who were put to death were those who would not confess, who professed their innocence. All the confessions that they did get under a lot of manipulation and pressure, which is interesting because we kind of just had a conversation about this last week, about when you're being interrogated and pressured and you have these children, right, who are perceived as innocent. There was this Puritan belief that children were kind of young adults in that they know better than to lie. So of course they wouldn't lie. So Salem witch trials, not a glowing piece of American history. There are a lot of theories out there on why these girls acted that way. The top 3 theories are related to a fungus that causes hallucinations, and they believe that maybe some of these children were in a way poisoned by this fungus that was in their wheat. There is also, they have the scientific evidence that actually that season in New England, there was a mini ice age. It was like one of the coldest winters in Northeast United States, and it influenced a sense of desperation among the people there. And then the last influence, and I kind of am of the opinion that probably it was a combination of all three, but of course the last theory is a idea of mass hysteria, which probably ties into the psychological maybe influence that you were talking about, where one girl who may have been hallucinating then was influenced by other girls. There's all this interesting research that the girls only ever quote unquote saw spirits or saw witches when there were other people in the room, right, to witness them. My focus here is there's probably a lot of reasons, and very few of them have to do with actual people practicing witchcraft, which is a thing, right? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, whether you believe in witches as a thing, I don't know what to call them, as a lifestyle or not, you know, belief in witches has been around since the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages is where the superstition about black cats came from, because they believed that witches, to escape detection, would turn into a black cat to get away. So that is why people feared black cats, because they believed they were witches.
I didn't know that.
In hiding. Yeah, that's where the superstition about black cats. And did you know that black cats are the least likely to get adopted in animal shelters? And that breaks my heart.
Oh.
Because I think it's so stupid, because I personally, and I'm not a witch, I'm not a witch.
Said every witch ever.
I think black cats are beautiful. Actually, the earliest record of like the existence of witches, so record being written in text, is actually in the Bible. So 1 Samuel, which they believe was written between 931 and 721 BC, is actually the first written record of witches. I'm not really sure, especially with the history and the superstitions and how it is still prevalent. Yeah, there's just kind of when these kids are sitting around a lunch table freaking out, this little kid being like, oh, they have red hair.
Right.
I think one time I told Kelly, do you remember this? I was like, redheads, it's a mutation of their genes. And you were like, they're not X-Men. It's not a mutation.
I don't remember that.
And I was like, okay, but I think it's kind of fun. I always wanted to be a redhead growing up.
That I did know. Because of Anna Green Gables.
Which is ironic because Anne wanted to be a brunette. What are you going to do? These girls of whimsy. Okay, I think that is all that I had to add on the Salem witch trials.
Okay. Some of the things that you've already said, the red hair, spooky eyes, they wear black.
Oh yeah, wearing black, taking your, fattening you up to eat you.
They melt if you put, if they're in water. If you see their reflection in a mirror, you'll see their warts. Yeah. And while this is all going on, let's just say we know that Brian is very gullible. So he's quite convinced.
The thing I think that's important is Brian is like new to this believing in superstitious stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is a new fascination for him, which I think is very typical kid. At least for me, it was like I was not into something and then I discovered something I was into and then I was like, I'm so into this.
Yes, you had many phases of which we won't speak. Right after this scene, we're actually in the barber shop and Lauren is reading in the newspaper about a murder that happened in Hackett Mountain, which I thought was quite an ironic name. Jake and Lauren are talking, and Jake is finishing up a shave on this man who we don't recognize.
But my favorite part is he's like, oh, this guy chopped up his best friend with an ice pick. And Jake's like, don't get any ideas. Yeah. Which I was like, funny, but also, aw, he's saying they're best friends.
That was funny. Anyway, so Jake finishes up this shave on a man. Oh my goodness, he can't get him to wake up. At first he's like, all right, pay up, man. He picks his pockets, basically.
Takes his
slaps mind. Him awake and is like, go over to the saloon if you want to sleep. Anyway, they find that this man is not alive. And Jake says, I think he's had his last shave, meaning he is dead. So what do they do? Well, before they do that, the next scene is in the mercantile. And Dr. Mike is trying to come up with costume ideas for Colleen and Brian. And Brian does not like any of her ideas. None at all. And we find out the reason why is that his ma used to make their costumes. And then we have a continuation where Jake runs over and says, Dr. Mike, I really need you. So we run back over to the shop. And there's quite the crowd, which I'm like, guys, really? Typical. Just staring at a dead... It is typical, but also like, why are we just staring at a dead person? Like, as they pull the sheet back from this dead body, it's Lauren who jumps out and scares Dr. Mike, which is kind of genius, actually. Like, I've seen this episode, but I forgot about
it. So can I show you my notes? Because I was writing. Can you see how it says, Jake comes to get Dr. Mike? And if you look at the end of Mike... Do you see how my writing goes scribble? I actually jumped because I didn't know it was coming. And so I'm writing Mike and then boo, and the mic pen like went off the paper. And then I just had to laugh for like 5 minutes. I'm like, they got me.
Yeah.
In addition to getting Dr. Mike.
No, it was very clever. And Dr. Mike is pretty ticked off. Like, she did not think it was funny.
She did not funny enjoy at all. The joke.
She's like, you guys are overgrown children, which I'm going to use that. I like that.
I mean, I think it's fair in the way that she was coming to inspect a dead person.
Yeah.
Like, the prank by itself, funny. Joke in context of she's coming over to check on a guy who died, less funny.
Right. Well, and then there's the issue of they're like, oh, no, actually, there's really a dead body. And they're having quite a hard time convincing her. And when they finally get her to come over, I guess they put him in a tub, which is, like, a very weird place to put. a dead person.
Why does Jake have this honking copper tub in the back of his barbershop?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you.
I'm sorry. This the picture of Jake after a long day of cutting men's hair, lounging in this copper bathtub just really, really messes with my vision of who he is as a person.
No, but of course he's gone. The man is gone. And Dr. Mike's like, oh yeah, so he just got up and walked out of here. And they're like,
It's very Boy Who Cried Wolf, right?
Correct.
Part of me loves imagining the part where they're like, oh, this man's dead. We should go get Dr. Mike. I kind of like imagining the scene where Lauren's like, hey, you know what would be funny? If we like scare Dr. Mike, one of us jumps out our, it'll be so funny. And Jake being like, yeah, that's a great idea.
I think it was intended to bring us joy.
What are you thinking when there's not a dead man, even though you've seen it?
Somebody stole the body.
I don't know what I was thinking. I mean, I was obviously thinking that guy got up out of that bathtub and walked away, but how did no one see him?
Right.
Was he faking? I was waiting for him to have like stolen stuff or something.
Oh, wow. My brain didn't go there.
Like he just walked away with a big bathtub.
Oh, gosh.
Brian's still in the mercantile where Dorothy recognizes that he seemed quite upset and not very excited when trying to plan out a costume. I mean, Dorothy's the only redhead in town, so obviously I know where this is going. But also, I'm thinking, why is Dorothy suddenly wearing so much black? But then I remembered, she's probably in mourning.
It's true. I forgot.
Actually, in the last episode, her husband died. And I know he was an abuser, but also for the time period, it would actually make sense that she's wearing that black shawl to show that she's in mourning.
No, that's probably true. I didn't think of that.
Brian reveals that Charlotte always used to make their costumes for the Halloween festival as a surprise. She never told them what they were going to be. And he was always looking forward to whatever his mom would reveal. And so it's hard for him to look forward to Halloween and having to make his own decision because he liked the surprise of it all. And Dorothy reveals that, like any good pumpkin latte, autumn candle loving woman, she loves Halloween. I feel like there are a lot of people who love not just Halloween, but like fall. There's a black cat in the shop, which if Lauren was in his shop right now, he probably would be pulling out the broom. But Dorothy's like, oh, look at this beautiful cat. But the way she's saying it and the way that Brian is looking at her is very obvious. His mind is running wild.
Yeah.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yes. The next scene is in the homestead at night. Dr. Mike wakes up to a baby crying, and she goes into the barn where she thinks she hears it, and she looks in an old trunk, and she finds this unfinished rocking horse. And as soon as she finds it, she also briefly sees the ghost of a woman who we do not know yet.
This scene is actually creepy. They build the tension well.
It is weird, and I'm like, wow, I just summed it up in like a sentence, but it is, there's a, you know, it kind of drags on for a little bit, but then Matthew wakes up in the barn and she says, I thought I heard something. And that's kind of it. That whole scene just like finishes just like that.
I was like, it's not crazy for her to actually think she hears a baby in the barn because that did happen once before.
True. The next morning we have Sully, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, ready to start on Colleen's room. He has the wagon, he has the supplies, and you know those probably weren't cheap. And Dr. Mike is very adamant. Sully, who's that?
Sully.
Who's Sully? Sully, Sol, as I like to call him. She's very adamant that he not do anything. And her reasoning becomes, you know, it's not my home. And he's like, of course it is. You live here. And she's like, you built it for Abigail. I still think of it as her house. And he's like, it's not. And she's like, it is. And then basically he's like, fine, and leaves. Their conflict resolution isn't great yet.
Personally, in this scene, unfortunately, Dr. Mike has to be very defensive in saying no. He just doesn't want her to say no, and he's not listening to her say no. He's just being like, "This, that's dumb. What are you talking about?" for me, it would have been really nice to see him actually, he never asked her, what are you so scared of? Or what's concerning you? Or can you explain this to me? Instead, he just is pushing. That's not a good reason. So she's very much on the defensive. We've talked about consent before, but that no is a full sentence. And I think it's okay for him to want to find out more information why she's struggling with this, but instead he just kind of takes it personally, which is sort of flipped for their characters. I feel like I'm used to her taking things personally. We kind of are still not totally sure of her reasons. You know, he's just being like, this is my plan. I want to make things nice for you, right? But it's like, I want, it's not like, what do you want to make this place nicer for you and the kids?
And at the same time, I think his intention is good. And his thought is like, I'm trying to do something nice for you. And, you know, I don't think he thinks she's being ungrateful, but I couldn't blame him if he was, of like, I'm trying to do something nice for you. Can you just let me do something nice for you and not be this way right now? And so, yeah, they don't exist. And I think part of that's because they have not had this like conversation about what their relationship is. Therefore, there are expectations on both sides and there's things that haven't been said. So it's a bit confusing. 100%. Yeah.
I mean, the last conversation they had obviously was in Portraits, where they acknowledged we have feelings for each other, but we're both not ready to pursue a relationship, which that's a hard line to walk then.
Right. Especially when he says a lot of that is because of Abigail. And now he's trying to say to her, like, it's not about Abigail. It's not a big deal. It's just a house. Like, it belongs to you. So, yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot there for sure.
We're back at the mercantile. I would assume that Brian has gone back. Dorothy's still wearing dark colors, and he tries to get her to look in a mirror because he wants to see if she can see her warts or something. Like, he holds it up in a way that he couldn't see what she sees. When you're looking at it from her perspective, it's very sweet. She's like, oh, can you rub it off for me? Thanks. She takes his jacket very suddenly, a little aggressively, like, let me have this. And she's like, I'm going to clean it for you because you've been so sweet to me. And you can see the wheels turning. I got to say, Sean Tuvey, performance-wise, really shows up in this episode because you can see his wheels turning, being like, the children had said, if she takes your clothes, it's to put a hex on you or something. Right. But he's also like this very polite little child that's like, she's like, oh, don't worry, I'll give it back. And he's like, okay.
Right. After that happens, he gets freaked out after she takes his jacket and he runs off again.
Yep.
In the saloon, we have Hank and he's being a jerk and telling Myra to go, quote unquote, stir up some business. She walks up to this gentleman whose face we don't see because he's face down. And she's trying to talk to him, trying to start up conversation, and he's not responding. And so as she walks away, Hank's pressing her to do her job, and she's like, I'm pretty sure he's like wasted, like I don't think he'd wake up even if we wanted to. And then when they actually do try to wake him up, lo and behold, he will not wake up. And Hank's response is, oh, just some, what does he say, like, nothing to see here or something,
little mishap, nothing to worry about. Yeah,
casually. And then he drags him out.
Yeah, which we should talk about. This guy Tom Poston is credited as Mysterious Dead Man. That is his character name.
That is funny.
I mean, yeah, that's who he is. But I learned, Kelly, because I know you will appreciate this, he was one of the voice characters on Liberty's Kids. And we don't hear him talk in this, but Liberty's Kids is the cartoon that pretty much I give a huge amount of credit to my love of history is because of that TV show.
That's funny.
The next scene, Brian tries his second tactic. Gotta give him props. It's got a scientific mom who he has a hypothesis and he is trying to prove that hypothesis. Sees Miss Dorothy. She's feeling sort of hot on a hot, I don't know why it's hot.
Hot
it's
October.
Obviously October.
It could be hot in Colorado.
Maybe it's because she's wearing black. You know, black, they say, is
got like, a lot of layers on.
Yep. He comes up with a glass of water because she looks like she's parched. And instead of offering it her to drink, he just throws it on her but misses. She's like so sweet about it. Like, no problem, Brian. It's the thought that counts. Then she just thinks he's so sweet that she gives him an apple. And then she talks to him like he's a toddler, which is a little weird. Where she's like, you're just so precious, I could eat you up. Yeah. And I'm like, I would be creeped out too. But it doesn't help that she's given him food and talked about wanting to eat him. And there's more cats. I think there's more than one black cat he also sees outside the mercantile that day. Little Brian is pretty sure that there's a witch in Colorado Springs and she's got her eye on him.
Dr. Mike comes riding into town, and of course, Hank goes to get her, and, you know, he says, oh, I need to show you something, and then he starts to explain about the man in the saloon, and that he put him in this wagon, and of course, as soon as they get to the wagon, the man is nowhere to be found. And Dr. Mike thinks it's another prank. She's, like, getting, like, royally ticked off now. She's like, okay, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. We'll get to the third one.
She's kind of like, I should have known.
Right.
Jake and Lauren put you up to this.
Yep. Those three. It's not completely absurd to think that that is possible. Yeah.
This episode actually has quite a few humorous moments as well. But this is one of the things where I'm not sure the timeline, because she was with Brian in the store yesterday. She had the weird experience overnight. Then it shows Brian and Matthew in town, but then Dr. Mike was with Sully at the homestead that morning, and then she's riding in the afternoon. This is where I'm like, is this all one day?
Yeah, it kind of is hard to know, isn't it?
It's a little confusing. Flashback then again, after that scene, she's having a nightmare. It's evening. She's hearing sounds again, and all of a sudden, we get a good look at the ghost. I know that she might be dreaming, and I know she probably doesn't believe in ghosts. If anyone is just suddenly standing in my house, it doesn't matter whether I know them or not, but I'm screaming. If someone who's not supposed to be in my house is suddenly in my house, but she's so calm. Who are you?
Maybe it's because she knew this was coming. Maybe because, like, you know what I mean? I don't know.
And this is where that whole the Cheyenne, the belief that when we're sleeping, our spirit wanders, that she's facing some of her own
insecurities,
inner conflict. Yeah, inner insecurities. And it's something that she internally has to make peace with. They don't tell us explicitly whether this is in her head or actually happening. But yeah, anyway, it's Abigail. And she asks Abigail what she wants. And Abigail says, I want you out of my house.
I want you out of my house. And that's it.
I mean, it's a simple request. Get out.
And that's kind of the end of that scene, actually.
So Dr. Mike comes up with a plan to appease Abigail's departed soul, spirit, ghost.
Yes. So she goes to Robert E's and she asks to speak with Sully. And she actually brings him the rocking horse. I don't remember what episode it was before, but remember when... Well, I think it was...
The healing.
Was it the healing or was it... I was thinking more of... Isn't it Cowboy's Lullaby when they use the clothes? Oh, you're right.
It is Cowboy's Lullaby.
Just he gets really upset about it, right? So he's kind of a little upset of like, where'd you find that?
Yeah, his first comment is, it's not yours.
Well, it's not. I feel like I'm defending Sully this entire episode and you're defending Dr. Mike. It's funny.
She didn't say it was hers. She brought it to him. So the assumption would be...
Well, it's like bringing up memories of a very traumatic past for him, okay? Anyway, she's like, I need you to do something for me. I need you to finish the horse. I just need you to do it. He basically is like, okay, why? I don't get that. I'm not going to do that. Also, why do you want me to do this, but you won't let me work on the homestead?
Which is fair.
Yeah, yeah. And she actually, you know, starts to give an explanation again because she's given a number of them. And she says right. It would mean something permanent, you know, for you to do that.
It annoys me that she keeps having to give him reasons, to be honest. But I think also another fair answer. They haven't had a conversation beyond we have feelings for each other. And so, yeah, to have him expanding on this house that she's renting from him, right? She's renting this home from him, but it's weird because they are very close. They've acknowledged their feelings for each other, but they're not pursuing that any further. I think it's fair that she is setting these boundaries and he gets mad and acts like a child. He throws, this is like a temper tantrum.
It's not a temper tantrum.
Literally, he's like, oh, yeah, sure, I'll fix it. And then he tosses it in the fire.
Well, no, he says, you're overthinking this, you're making things in your head. Again, I see where you're coming from. They probably should have just sat down and had an adult conversation about this. Instead, they're having little mini things. And then, yes, he says, I don't want this horse fixed. And he throws it in the fire. That is what happens, yes.
You and I have talked about this before. The chief way to upset me as a person is to invalidate the way that I'm feeling about something. The whole start of this episode was they don't have to agree on everything. So even if he doesn't agree with how she's feeling, that's how she's feeling. Instead of rejecting that, he should be having a conversation with her about that, either to see what he can do to alleviate those feelings or acknowledge that she has those feelings and that he's willing to wait until she's ready.
Right, which doesn't happen, unfortunately. We're back at the schoolhouse and Brian is telling the kids, Dorothy's a witch. She's got red hair, black shawl. She's got this black hat. She wouldn't look in the mirror. I tried to get water on her. And he's basically convincing them.
She took my jacket.
Oh, yeah. She took my clothes. And they're like, oh, my gosh. She took your jacket? You better hope she doesn't put a hex on you. They're not super believing. And he's like, well, come with me and I'll show you. I will prove to you that Dorothy is a witch.
At the cemetery, Dr. Mike has brought flowers for Abigail's grave, and she meets Lauren there. And note about timeline, Abigail's tombstone, which is different than the tombstone we have seen, I think, in the pilot.
Oh, really?
Abigail's tombstone reads 1839 to 1865, which 1865, that's the year that the Civil War ended. It threw me off a little bit because, oh, I meant to do the math. Can you do the math? If she was born in 1833, what year should she have turned 35 for her birthday?
Yeah, 1868.
I know we talked about it before, but I couldn't remember. So at least for the happy birthday episode, it's been 3 years since Abigail died. And she's been there, which this is where she reveals that she's only been in Colorado Springs for less than a year, which is crazy to me.
It is. I think it just, I keep just like not getting that because she's such a prominent figure in their town now that, I don't know.
Like, unless these episodes are happening like every other day, I'm just like, I feel like so much time has passed.
Right.
Sometimes these episodes stretch out and they feel like there's literally months in between.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Yeah. Which obviously is not, that's not what they want us to be feeling, but that's what I have been perceiving. I don't know. How do you feel about this conversation? So obviously, Dr. Mike asks a question that it's surprising to realize that she has not ever asked anyone what Abigail was like before. But I think it makes sense that she asked Lauren because it would certainly be uncomfortable to ask Sully, who never wants to talk about his wife or his daughter.
Yeah.
That's not true. Not that he never wants to talk about it, but that he does not talk about them when pressed. It's when he wants to.
Right.
Lauren's description is she was quiet, elegant, sweet. She never argued. That's the one where I was like,
I like that he adds, except with me, of course.
Yeah.
Like any good dad-daughter duo.
Within the context of our podcast, he also says she was a real lady, which I think is sort of iconic because when we met Dr. Mike, one of her best lines is, I'm not a lady, I'm a doctor. And so the whole thing is meant to be this parallel.
Correct.
Her line right after is, nothing like me. I don't think she needed to say that, but I know that they're definitely wanting to make sure that we as the audience are recognizing, like, yeah, they are two very, very different women. What were your thoughts on her asking Lauren?
Yeah, I think it gives us a glimpse into what internal conflict she's already been having, you know, which is thinking about Abigail, thinking about how that is a big factor that is possibly holding them back in their relationship. And then thinking about comparing. I mean, and I don't want to say every woman does that, but you do. And so I think she's been struggling with that. So you kind of get to see that. I think Lauren is a good person to ask because, again, we haven't heard a lot from him on that subject. But also she has in my opinion, a good relationship with Lauren for the most part.
Depends on the day of the week.
She's looking for some confirmation, right? She's looking for validation of what she has already suspected, what she's already thinking, and she's getting it, right? We'll see that this kind of gets resolved when she has a conversation with Abigail later on, but no, I think it was a good way for us to kind of see what's going on in Dr. Mike's head, because as we've said before, like, we think that's probably what's holding her up with all these homestead renovations, but we don't really know, right? And now we're just getting these, like, weird, like, oh, she saw Abigail, and then she saw Abigail again, like, in her sleep, in her dream, whatever. So I guess that's what I would say.
It's creative to choose to do this kind of haunting episode as Dr. Mike's opportunity to confront her own feelings about Abigail. It makes sense. We had a conversation in season one where we talked about where she was kind of pressuring Sully to face his own feelings about Abigail, where we were like, I'm not sure that's totally appropriate. And it's super interesting that they're doing it still, again, before this couple has even really pursued any sort of relationship. I think you're right that our culture just wires women to compare themselves to other women, right? It's not healthy. It's not what we want for the world, right? We want women to empower one another, but it speaks to our culture and our societal norms, which says, yeah, like, we, of course we compare ourselves to other women. I think what's important and what will come up is also Dr. Mike has this unsettling feeling of guilt. She has this beautiful thing of a family and a really awesome guy who is interested in her. Abigail was such this lovely person and deserved to, you know, grow old with her child and her husband in the house that he built for her. And she wasn't able to. This is not a healthy question, but asking if she actually deserves to be happy in this way when there are women like Abigail who didn't get it.
Yeah, which I think is why she's searching for that confirmation. That's not healthy, but you know what I mean? She wants to hear what she already suspects. And Lauren does it in a way that's, you know, it's not malicious or anything. It's like, this is my daughter and I have high regards for her, but also you two are very different and that's all. And this is when he makes the comment of like, maybe I've only ever come to the homestead once because of Abigail, but maybe it's because you never invite me. Which is interesting because we've seen her invite like strangers, like one-time guest stars over.
Yep.
And the only time I can remember him coming over was last episode. Yeah. At Grace's Cafe. Here's my third time. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Fool me three times. What is it?
I don't know.
Fool me three times, shame on both of us. That's dumb. Why didn't we guess that? Anyway, Grace is serving meatloaf to our mysterious dead man. And
then she walks away, and then Matthew comes for lunch.
And Matthew tries to be kind and make conversation, and the guy ends up falling over into his meal, which is pretty classic. That is pretty classic, like, dying move in movies.
Do you know what Matthew says? I wrote down a direct quote. Uh-oh. Literally, I'm like, okay, I know that these people were probably around death a lot more than us, but if I sit down at a table and the man there is dead, I'm not just going to be like, uh-oh. Uh-oh.
Well, and of course, what happens is they go to get Dr. Mike and she's like, oh yeah, there's a dead guy. Really? Don't expect me to fall for this. She's pretty aggressively accusing Matthew and Grace of being in on this plot to make her look like a fool.
Grace, like, gets these, like, big eyes, and she's like, I am telling you, there is a dead man.
And unfortunately, when she does give in to go see, the man is gone, and then she's mad. Grace and Matthew! And walks away.
I guess that night, I don't know if Colleen and Brian and all these other kids have snuck out, or maybe it's not that late, or they got permission, but the kids are camped out outside the Mercantile, watching in a window to see if they can spot Dorothy being witch-like, and all the other kids are ready to give up when suddenly she comes in the room. She's carrying something, and it looks like a body. This is what they should have done. They should have been like, that's who's stealing the dead bodies. Because none of the people have connected that it's all the same guy. So far, we've had three men die in different locations in the town and their bodies disappear. The kids, they don't really react. They're just kind of like, what? They're just like, oh, it's a body. I'm out of here.
Yeah, and they're all about to leave. And then Brian tries to get him to stay. And then all we really see is Brian linger by the window.
And I guess it's that same night. But this is where I start to get suspicious.
Suspicious.
Because we're at the homestead. This is the second conversation Dr. Mike has had with this ghost. And the kids are not waking up. Which is obviously to make us suspicious that it's in her head. But are the kids not home? Because they were at the mercantile? Not sure.
Abigail throws the flowers that Dr. Mike placed on her tombstone. And says, I want you out. And this time she adds, and away from my husband. What's interesting to me in this scene is we've seen Dr. Mike do this very big comparison between the two of them. And I don't think it ever occurred to me that Abigail would be doing the same thing because, well, she's dead. But Abigail starts to talk about the fact that Dr. Mike has three beautiful children. She has Abigail's home. She has Abigail's husband. And Abigail feels like she has nothing. And it's interesting because then Dr. Mike kind of switches to this mindset of like, how dare you be so selfish? Be so selfish on this, you know, and if you really cared about Sully, you would want him to be happy. This isn't easy for me either. And right. She starts to talk about that she'll always be compared to Abigail, even though they're so different. The dialogue they're having is kind of important because Dr. Mike says, I don't know how Sully could love two different women, which we'll talk about in a second, but also... Do you flash back to the conversation they had last episode?
Yeah, where he asked her, would you want the man you loved to love another woman or something like that?
Yeah. So I started thinking about that. And then I'm also thinking about the fact of like, oh, she's saying, and we've had this conversation on the show too. Do they love each other or whatever? They haven't said they love each other.
They haven't. Yeah.
But like Dr. Mike says it very confidently. And even Abigail questions it like, oh, how do you know he loves you? Actually, he loves me. He married me. He had a kid with me. How dare you be so selfish?
This is the where I would make the argument for this is Dr. Mike's own insecurities, that maybe this is why she's having trouble accepting some of these gestures, because he hasn't said he loves her. And so if we're playing this as this Abigail is the Abigail that is in Dr. Mike's mind, then this is an acknowledgement. Oh, we didn't know that bothered her. And this is not a big complaint, but we've just had this description of Abigail being sweet and kind and never raising her voice. But then in this part, she's quite petulant. I almost liked it better when she was more eerie and chilling because she's this ghost of Abigail. Like, this is not really Abigail, right? This is the ghost of Abigail.
And I think we have to remember too that this is Dr. Mike working through her insecurity and her stuff. Like it's not, I don't know, part of me is like, who knows if Abigail would even feel that way? Who knows if Abigail would even...
Yeah, exactly. Part of the grieving process is not forgetting, but it is like letting go of the hurt that comes with that grief.
Yeah, definitely.
I'd almost like them to more define that this is not Abigail. It's either the ghost of Abigail, which plays off this Halloween that the barrier between worlds is thin, which is why she would show up in the place that she died, versus she's just a figment of Dr. Mike's own creation,
right,
where she's struggling to come to terms with, I'm in love with a man who married someone else, loved someone else, was going to spend the rest of his life with this person.
Yeah, true.
We're assuming it's that same night, but now Brian has broken into Lauren's house. I don't know if he's looking for his jacket or if he's looking for the body. If he's looking for the body, what a brave little boy.
I think he's looking for his jacket. He wants to get his jacket back because Alice says again, like, oh, you better get your jacket back.
Yeah. He goes into a room and there's a
thing. A mannequin?
A mannequin, yeah. There's like a mannequin wearing a devil's costume and it falls on him. And then Dorothy comes in and it all comes out. Like, well, what are you doing? What are you doing here? There's a devil. Oh, no. It's your costume. You wanted to be surprised about your costume, so I made you a costume, which is like very sweet. And she's like, I wanted to surprise you, and I took your jacket for a pattern so that I would know your size. And it's all like, it's all clicking. And we're like, oh, he realizes all this. But before they can really talk things out, a brick smashes through the window and we hear chanting and yelling.
Witch, 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 witch.
If I'm Dorothy, I'm not walking outside where the brick just came through the window. But the kids dump a whole bucket of water on her. I guess they realize that she's not a witch because she doesn't, you know, Wizard of Oz. I'm melting. That doesn't happen. And so suddenly everyone's quiet. She takes it very well. I don't know. I would be livid. None of the kids say anything else, but Brian, of course, realizes that it's his fault. He explains he thought she was a witch. Dorothy confesses that she's been missing her own children, so maybe she was overly zealous in trying to be sweet to him and think of him. Like, she was being very generous. And she was trying to surprise him because he literally told her how much he looked forward to having surprises. This is where I wanted to say Tony Graffia wrote this script.
Right.
Also wrote The Secret. Some of Sean Tuvey's best work. This scene where he breaks down crying about not remembering what his mom looked like and how when he called her, she didn't come. Mm. And surely she's forgotten him. This scene is so heartfelt and emotional. And both of them, Barbara Babcock and Sean Tuvey, I think really, really tie into this heartbreak and this loss of family. And I'm flashing back to, you know, Brian and Zach in the closet.
Yeah.
Tony Graffia writes really, really heartfelt, and not just for Brian, but I feel like Brian really gets to dig deep into some of these very real emotions and very real, in a way, almost trauma. And it's a really nice moment too, because of course Dorothy is a mother.
Right.
Gets to share moms don't forget their children. I'm not sure about this timeline, but it turns out that Dorothy actually knew Charlotte well. Was that before she married Marcus? It couldn't have been, because we know Charlotte had been without her husband for only 4 years or so. So there's some of the timeline is weird.
I guess I assumed that.
Because didn't Dorothy say she didn't really visit? I guess maybe she did visit Maud, but they weren't close or something.
But I mean, even Sully knew her. I guess part of me was, I mean, we don't know where Maud and Dorothy grew up. So it's kind of hard to say.
Didn't they say something about Maud and Lauren moved to Colorado Springs from?
Oh, you're right.
Some other state.
Right.
It threw me off in this very emotional, heartfelt scene where the comfort that Dorothy is able to offer Brian is that Charlotte wanted Brian. She wanted a third kid. She wanted a baby boy. In an episode about not giving into your superstitions, they kind of play up like, oh, we had the superstition that if she found a four-leaf clover,
yeah,
then she was going to get pregnant with you. It is a very sweet scene. I'm going to say it one more time, but I think Sean Tuvey is great in this scene.
Yeah.
Beyond just being, it's sad when you see little kids cry, but I think the emotion that he taps into about missing his mom, but not wanting to say anything to Dr. Mike because he doesn't want her to feel bad. Like, oh man, that's so heavy. Like, you don't realize the things that kids carry around and...
Mm.
And it's not even that he thinks Dr. Mike wouldn't understand. It's that he just doesn't want to hurt Dr. Mike by saying, I miss my mom.
Right.
The scene closes with, turns out Dorothy actually has that four-leaf clover. And she gives it to Brian and they hug. She forgives him, but I'm also like, what are we going to do about the broken window and these jerky kids? I guess the kids all left because they were like, oh, she didn't melt. Sorry, I hate to be that person to be like, wait,
I didn't even think about any of that.
There's a broken window. I think it's a really well-written, well-performed. This is why I love Dr. Quinn as a show, is that they're not afraid of these really deep emotional moments and they don't shy away from trauma and loss and grief and all that stuff.
Yeah. But then we are at the Halloween party. In town, we've got all sorts of costumes and they actually have a contest for the best costume. Third place going to Grace, who... You'll probably be able to Renaissance type, or is that the wrong time period?
It looked sort of Shakespearean. Yeah.
Yeah. Then we have Brian in his devil costume that Dorothy made. And first place goes to the Headless Horseman.
Before we move on, I've already talked about this in another episode. Matthew and Colleen are dressed in native dress. Don't do it, guys. Someone's culture is not a costume. Don't do it. Let's talk about the Headless Horseman, which is kind of funny because he's like an alive dead person.
Correct. Jake kind of says like, oh, reveal yourself. And of course, as everyone sees that it's this dead guy, they scream.
Half the town has seen this man in corpse pose.
I forget who. Is it Grace that tells Dr. Mike like, oh, that's the dead guy? Or is it Matthew? I don't know. Someone says to Dr. Mike.
Jake's the one giving the award. So when he opens, Jake's like, the dead man. And then the whole everyone screams because half the people were either in Lauren's shop or in the saloon or in Grace's cafe. They've all seen this person dead.
Correct. I just couldn't remember who had said it.
I think it might be Matthew because he's standing right next to her.
So then Headless Horseman, dead guy, proceeds to pass out. The next scene, we are in the clinic. And Dr. Mike is waking him up with, it's like, I don't know what she's using, ammonia or something. Anyway, she tells him, she does that thing. I don't like that she does, but I guess that's just how medicine was when you didn't have a lot of ways to confirm what someone's diagnosis was. You just kind of went with it. But she tells him that he has catalepsy. Do you know anything about that?
Nothing.
Well, you're going to be interested to hear what I say. Anyway, well, she goes on to say, oh, your limbs become rigid, your heart slows, your temperature drops. You're basically in a state of deep sleep, which is why people thought you were dead. And catalepsy is very rare. It's basically a neurologic condition in which your body, it doesn't respond to the external stimuli that we respond to. And by we, I mean people that don't have this. It can be caused by a lot of things. The way that I know it now is it's caused by, there's a lot of neuroleptic drugs, ketamine, Haldol, things like that that can cause it. There's also a lot of conditions like Parkinson's, epilepsy, even people that are going through withdrawal from cocaine can have this. It's more a set of symptoms, in my opinion, than like a condition that this guy will have forever or whatever. But anyway, there is that loss of muscle control and slowing down of bodily functions, which can include breathing, which is probably why people thought that this guy was dead. The first case ever recorded is actually 429 BC. So it's definitely been around for a while. And this is what you'll probably find interesting. It's thought to be what Shakespeare describes.
Romeo and Juliet.
Correct.
Oh, yes. Okay, so I did think that because Juliet takes a potion that makes her seem dead. She was trying to escape. And then Romeo thinks she's actually dead and then kills himself. And then she kills herself.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that, but I was like, no, that's weird.
Yeah. When I read some articles, it was saying that they think it's probably he was describing some cataleptic potion that then was able to slow down the bodily functions.
That makes sense.
So, yes. The only thing that, I mean, which would be very hard to do on camera, people that get this, when your brain like flips off, you are stuck, your body gets rigid in whatever position you were in. So like if he was...
Rigor. Yeah. What do they call that? Something rigor.
Rigor mortis. Yeah. Anyway, so, you know, when he's falling and stuff, obviously that doesn't happen. His body just, like, collapsed with it. But, I mean, that probably would have made them think he definitely was dead. So,
yeah.
Anyway, it is funny because then he's like, oh, why did everybody scream? And she's like, oh, you just had the scariest costume.
It wasn't until he showed his face that they screamed.
Right.
My thing is, I really wanted him to be like, oh, thanks for telling me that. I wondered why I wake up in all these random places that I don't remember going.
And that's why I'm like, he could have been sleepwalking. He could have been narcoleptic. I don't know. There's a lot of things. But yeah, apparently his life is exciting because that didn't faze him.
Like, he just wakes up in a copper bathtub in a haystack, like having finished his meal and there's no one in the restaurant.
Yeah. Not to mention, who is he if he's not like a regular townsperson? He's just there for Halloween festivities.
Yeah, I thought that too. Like, they don't recognize this guy enough to know that he showed up dead in multiple locations. Like, because they keep saying he's a dead man. They don't say like, hey, Joey died. Joey just passed out in the saloon. He's dead.
Okay.
I don't know why his name is Joey.
Yes. The end of that scene actually ends with what?
Sully shows up. He doesn't really apologize, but he does say, I shouldn't have done what I did.
Nobody's perfect.
No, I don't expect him to be perfect.
I mean, I do. He is perfect. Are you kidding me?
I just, if you're going to say sorry or say I shouldn't have done that or I shouldn't have done what I did, please be more specific.
Yeah. Well, that's why I say
because she wasn't mad at him for not fixing the horse. She wasn't even mad at him. She was just saying no and he wasn't taking no. The listeners can tell me, am I too harsh on Sully?
I get what you're saying. I think we've established, though, that their ability to work through conflict is not very great.
It's true. It's a good thing they haven't started dating yet, because it's probably something they need to figure out. But he didn't fix the horse. I think it seems like he must have made a new rocking horse.
I think he waited until she left Robert E's and then he put the bar out and dug it out and was like, oh, shoot, why did I do that? I'm dumb.
I can agree with that. So it transitions to that night. Dr. Mike is calling to Abigail, but Abigail doesn't come. So she makes herself comfortable by the fire, which this is where it, of course, is hinting at that maybe this is all something that's just happening in her sleep. She wakes up. Some amount of time has passed and Abigail is there. I like what Dr. Mike says, that you may not care about me, but I do care about you and I care about your child. And what's important to me is that I would have helped you. I'm a good doctor.
Yeah.
Which I also like this hint that, you know, we had this thing about, oh, Abigail was a real lady. And that's one of the things that sets her apart from Dr. Mike. And Dr. Mike's like, you know, I don't know if I deserve this or that or if I am going to be whatever, but I am a good doctor and I care about you. Ghost Abigail cries over the horse. And then it ends nicely where Abigail does tell Dr. Mike, I think we would have been friends, which I think they would have too, even though we don't really know Abigail, but just thinking about the type of person that Sully would love.
Yeah.
They would have been different, but that's, this whole town is full of people who are different, who can form good relationships, you know? Yep.
Yeah, definitely.
What do you think the symbolism of giving her the rocking horse is?
I think it's a gesture from Dr. Mike because, yes, she knows it's something that represents that family. And so for her to be able to care about Sully and be able to ask Sully to do that is one thing that speaks for Dr. Mike. But then I think also, yeah, that Abigail's big point was he loves me, he married me, he had a kid with me. And that's true. He does love her. And obviously that's a big part of his life. So for him to do that, I think also kind of gives Abigail, or Dr. Quinn's, you know, figment of imagination of Abigail, a reason to feel the care, the love, whatever, from Sully is also there. I think it's a little bit of both.
Dr. Mike does say, like, I'm not trying to replace you or be better than you.
And she says, I don't want Sully to forget you, you know?
Yeah. As a viewer, I never felt like that's what Dr. Mike was trying to do. But obviously she's wrestling with, you know, her own inner demons that maybe that's what Abigail would see.
Right. Yeah.
And then Dr. Mike wakes up. And I can't remember if the horse is there or not.
It's gone.
Is it gone?
Correct. It's gone.
So that's weird to me, like, because they almost make it seem like it's in her head. But then if the horse is gone, then that makes it seem like it's real. I would have liked if they would let it more ambiguous of, is it there, is it not? Kind of like the spinning top in Inception. We don't need to know if the top stops.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's...
We don't need to know if it was real or not, because it was more about the character development than actually about ghosts. But I guess it's a Halloween episode. They want to be like, yo, ghost.
For all we know, you know, the dead man took it and had a fun time. I don't know. And what happens here is Dr. Mike hears the children outside. She finds them playing with Sully, and she basically says, thank you, Sully. And he asks her what happened to it. And she says, it went to a child who needed it. So it's their way of tying it up, right? They do this. We've seen this with episodes. Yeah. They need a way to tie it up. And then she announces they're going to fix up the homestead. And that is because I think she has come to terms with her emotions about Abigail, her emotions about what's holding her back.
She doesn't have to overthink what it means for him, because she's dealt with what it means for herself.
Yeah. And Brian hugs her, which I think is their way of kind of tying that storyline up, too.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the episode. Halloween. Favorite scene? My favorite scene? I want to say the end. That's like two. No, probably the scene with Dorothy and Brian.
Yeah, I really like that one. I also personally like Lauren and Dr. Mike's scene at mm-hmm. Abigail's grave. I think it does a lot of work for Dr. Mike's character and the journey of all the characters, actually. And it does some like world building where we get some perspective on a lot of things before Dr. Mike became an essential part of Colorado Springs. So I really think that scene was really well written and gave some nice insight into these relationships that we've been watching develop for apparently less than a year.
Seriously, I know. Now the hard part, when it comes to just season two, this compared to Sanctuary, compared to The Race. Season two wise, it's a fun episode. It's has a message episode. It's not the best message. I don't know. It's not the best clear laid out. So I think when it comes to season two, I'd probably put it third on the list. Not because I didn't like it, just because the other two, I think, are better at relaying a message.
It's so funny because my initial thought is like, I think I enjoyed this one most so far. Oh. But not because I didn't like the others. I just did like this one.
I also just think the whole ghost thing is weird.
Yeah. Let's look at the criteria. Personal preference, writing, story, performances, themes, values, character development, conflicts, memorability, likelihood to watch again. I just like the writing in this episode. Conflicts in comparison to, I feel like The Race kind of stands very classic, what we would expect from Dr. Quinn. Sanctuary obviously was dealing with definitely a very real conflict, very relevant conflict. And then this one's like kind of in its own, like there's like this aspect because it's the ghost that makes it feel like almost not a real episode, I guess.
Right.
I mean, I think it's better than Epidemic, Cowboy's Lullaby. The further we get from some of these episodes, the more I'm like, why is that one there?
I know. I'm like, why is that so low?
Definitely better conflict and theme than Father's Day and Heroes Healing and Cowboy's Lullaby, right? Those were both about letting go of the past in different ways, as is this one, right?
Right.
This one is also, so I think it probably sits right in there with the Healing and Cowboy's Lullaby.
Yeah.
I mean, it's definitely funnier than both of those.
Right.
So above Cowboy's Lullaby, below the Epidemic?
I'd be good with that.
If we don't like it, we can move it later. So right now, it is sitting on our list as the new number 15.
We will look forward to hearing what your guys' thoughts are.
Yes.
Especially when it comes to Sully versus Dr. Mike's handling in this episode.
Our listeners like to discuss their relationship, so go ahead, yes, hit us with your opinions. What are we talking about next episode, Kel?
Next episode is The Incident.
What do we know about that one? Anything? Teaser?
Don't actually, from the name, I couldn't tell you exactly, actually. Although I think it has to do a lot with the Cheyenne.
Ooh, I like Cheyenne-centric episodes.
Yeah, so we'll definitely have a lot to talk about.
Sweet. That was our 20th Dr. Quinn episode discussion, so that's exciting.
Yeah, definitely.
And we hit our, I don't think we mentioned it officially, but we have passed now 1 year anniversary of Not a Lady being a podcast. We started it in September of 2020 and now October. So happy 1 year, Kel.
Happy 1 year.
Thanks to those of you who've been here with us since the beginning. And if
which
you're
is a number of you.
New, welcome.
Alrighty, folks, we will talk to you next time.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween, yeah.
Early or late or whenever you're listening to this episode.
Maybe I'll dress up as Dr. Quinn. I recently went hiking and someone told me I liked my jacket and I didn't tell them, but in my head I'm like, this is my Dr. Quinn jacket.
You should. You should.
Alrighty, see you guys next time.
Bye. Thank you for listening to this episode of Not a Lady, a Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, you might also enjoy visiting our website, www.notaladypodcast.weebly.com. There, you will find important resources and content related to Not a Lady podcast. You can also write to us with lessons or comments on our Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook pages, or by sending an email to notaladypodcast@gmail.com. You can support our podcast by liking and sharing our content on social media, or by giving us a review on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe so that you don't miss our next episode.